One of the things we're trying to highlight on Developmentor are people who have carved out their own path in tech. Not so much by zigging when everyone is zagging, but by fitting a bunch of job pieces together into a career puzzle. Today's guest has done just that by first getting a degree in computer science, then by working as a web developer and data journalist for a number of years, before going on to start his own company, Lanyrd, which he sold to Eventbrite. He's also worked for the likes of Yahoo, The Guardian News, and been an independent consultant. As if that's not enough, he's also one of the co-creators of Django, which stands as one of the most popular Python-based web development frameworks available. These days, he's getting back to his data journalism roots as a JSK journalism fellow at Stanford University, where he's creating a new data visualization and storytelling framework called Dataset. Stay tuned as we check in with Simon Willison.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Welcome to the show, Simon. Great to have you on.
Thanks a lot for having me on. This is going to be really fun.
Yeah, and I think, Simon, if I'm recalling correctly, we met circa 2009, maybe 2010, while you were at The Guardian. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I remember it was my first time in London, and I said to you and the team on one of our nights out, I don't want to go to any pub that's less than 400 years old, and you guys delivered.
Oh, that was pretty easy in The Guardian's location in central London. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But like for us Americans, like that's just not a thing you can do. So.
Our pubs are older than your country.
That's right. Thankfully, the beer was not older than our country, but it was indeed good. Well, and so it's so great to reconnect. I want to kick things off with a focus on perhaps the earlier parts of your career, your university time, and what inspired you to get into tech and pursue it both at university and as a career?
So my tech story actually starts back in the 90s. So when I was 18 years old, I got into online gaming. I was playing TFC, Team Fortress Classic, which it evolved into Team Fortress 2, which people play these days. But back then it was Half-Life mod that people were playing online. And I got involved running a league for it. So I was running the second largest Team Fortress Classic league in the United Kingdom for a company which was hosted by a company called Wireplay. And it was the dot-com boom. So there were suddenly all of these amazing jobs in tech. Nobody had the slightest idea what they were doing, but there was a lot of money flying into it. And so I got to spend a couple of years working in London in the first dot-com boom before everything collapsed, and working on the online gaming and working for a company called Gameplay.com, which sold games at a loss online and tried to make it up in volume, which it turns out is not a great business model. When the dot-com crash hit, I hadn't been to university yet. I had an offer from the University of Bath, which I delayed by a year. So I got to ride out the dot-com crash by doing my computer science degree at university.
Wow, that's fantastic. So you literally were getting paid to play games. I mean, that's like every kid's dream, right?
Technically, I was the downloads editor for the website. So I built and maintained a site called File Monster, where people could go and download mods and patches and demos and all of those kinds of things.
That's amazing. Well, how did you actually get that gig? I mean, were you like one of these, you know, kids who, you know, at 12 was writing their first program and was already kind of on the scene? Or did you happen to know somebody? I'm curious how you got even that gig.
This is a theme that I figured runs out throughout my career. I got it through a side project. I volunteered to help run this league. And then the person who was organizing the league dropped out. So it was just me. And the league needed a website. So I'd taught myself a tiny little bit of HTML. I actually cobbled together a system in Microsoft Excel for dynamically generating web pages, because leagues were all about league schedule tables. And so I had a formula where I'd fill in the cells, and then the cell at the end had equals, and then it string concatenated bits of HTML with the figures from the other cells. And I can copy and paste that out. And that actually worked pretty well. So I was running this website for this league. I was also running a website called TFC Central, which today you'd call it a blog, but we didn't know what a blog was back in 1999. I don't think the word had been coined yet. So it was a news website running on this amazing sort of freeware Perl script called NewsPro. And so I was running this website that had a community building around it, running this league. And when this company went looking for full-time employees, that was a sort of open invitation to go and talk to them.
Well, and I'm curious, I mean, you know, most 18-year-olds, you know, parents are usually pressuring, you should go to college. I mean, how did you kind of explain that to your parents? You're just like, hey, I'm going to do this for a year, or was there some bigger plan there?
I don't think this happens in America as much, but in the UK, there's an idea of a gap year, this idea that after high school and before university, you take a year off and maybe you go and earn money with a job, maybe you travel. I was working for Office World, which was the UK's equivalent of Staples. And so I had a pretty tedious retail job during the day, but in the evenings, I was running leagues, and had a clan that I was in, and I was building out this website and all of that kind of thing. And so then when the opportunity came up to go and work in London, because I had a university offer that I could delay for a year, it made sense to put that off for one more year and see what this whole .com thing was about.
And had you just taught yourself HTML? Was this the classic, learning by view source?
Absolutely, yes. It was all learning by view source. I can't even remember what resources were out there at the time, but at this company, I was the only person who wasn't using Dreamweaver, and everyone thought that was really weird that somebody would try and build a website without Dreamweaver.
Please tell me you had a lot of blink tags in your site too, right?
I can send you a screenshot. It didn't have blink tags. It's very online gamer style, black background and yellow text and all of those kinds of things.
And I think today, you know, if you brought it back, it'd probably be retro, right? And you definitely should send a screenshot so we can link that up in the show notes.
I will do that. I managed to dig it out of the Internet Archive. So that was very relieved that they'd captured a little snapshot of what I'd been building.
That's amazing. And so you go to university, computer science seems like the obvious choice there. Bring us forward then a little bit. What have been some of the key inflection points in your career to date? You know, I hit at some of these in the teaser, but there's pretty rich stories in there, I think.
So the big university thing was I started a blog. And again, this was, I think, in 2002, I started blogging, back when there weren't many people blogging. There were about 90 of us blogging about web development, like web technology. So all of the web tech bloggers knew each other, and we'd all link to each other and read each other's blogs and so forth. And then 2 years into university, we have an opportunity to do what's called a year in industry. So it's a 3-year degree. You do time at university. You can go out into the world and have a job for a year, essentially a sort of like extended paid internship. And then you go back and finish your degree. And my girlfriend at the time was going off to Germany for a year to do her year in industry. I hadn't planned to do one, but I figured, okay, if she's doing one, maybe I should take up this opportunity. And then Adrian Hulavarti, one of the 90 or so web development bloggers, posted a thing on his blog about how they were looking to hire somebody to work for a local newspaper in Lawrence, Kansas, which is, it's not the largest city in America. It's this tiny little town in Kansas with a local newspaper. And Adrian had been working there for quite a while. And some of the stuff they were doing was really exciting. And so when he posted this saying, you know, we want to build things the right way. We want to use CSS to style the pages of our newspaper. We want to build ourselves a publishing system and so on. It kind of meshed with my interests. I really respected Adrian. I'd been reading his stuff for like a couple of years. And it coincided with my university saying, hey, here's this opportunity. The great thing about a year in industry is you can get a student visa to go and do it. So it gives you the opportunity to work abroad in situations where otherwise it might be quite difficult to go and work in the United States for a year. So I got in touch with Adrian. I said, hey, would this work as a like year-long paid internship kind of deal? And we figured it out. And a few months later, I found myself on the ground in Lawrence, Kansas.
I think most Americans probably couldn't even pick out Lawrence, Kansas on the map. Like, what was that like?
Lawrence, it's a pretty amazing little town. Like, so I lived there for a year, but of course I'd never spent really any time in America at all, apart from like a few days in New York once. So I didn't really know how to compare it to the rest of America. I was told things like Lawrence was a town where they opened a giant like shopping mall and the townspeople boycotted it because they wanted to protect their downtown centers. The shopping mall got turned into a hotel instead. So a really strong local community. It's a college town. It's where the University of Kansas is. So it was sort of classic college town America. You could walk everywhere because it was pretty small, which was great because I didn't have to drive. And it also had literally the best entertainment website of any town I've ever visited. This is one of the websites that I got to work on. It was called Lawrence.com. And for this tiny little town, it had comprehensive event listing, a listing of every restaurant, every band in town. Lawrence was a very musical town. And you could go to a page on the website and see MP3s that you could listen to of local bands who were playing this week. And then you could go out to live music shows. And this was in 2003, 2004. Part of the reason the websites were so good is the company that ran the newspaper also ran the local cable company and had cable internet throughout this town. So Lawrence was a little town in Kansas with cable internet in 2003. And they were really pushing the boundaries of what you could do with a local newspaper when you had such a connected town. So since living in Lawrence for a year, I have visited lots of other towns in America. And it's one of those things where with the benefit of hindsight, you realize quite what a special little town it was. Like it really was a very, very sort of community-focused, really high standard of music and culture and arts. This tiny little college town in the that nobody's ever heard of.
You know, I've lived in a few college towns over the years as well, and there is often something quite special about them in terms of quality of life and intellectual pursuits and culture and all of that. And it sounds like Lawrence fit the bill there as well. Bringing that forward a little bit, you know, I think probably wasn't much later than where you started Django, this Python publishing framework, right? You know, I would love to hear that founding story.
Adrian and I were both PHP developers, and we were beginning to hit the limits of the size of PHP codebase you can work with before it all descended into spaghetti. I think this is the PHP 4 era. So like OOP and PHP was just being figured out. And we both really wanted to use Python. We'd been reading, there was a guy called Mark Pilgrim who wrote some fantastic, he actually wrote a free book about Python and all sorts of amazing articles. And we were really keen on using Python to build websites, but there weren't that many options for what today we'd call frameworks for working with Python. I think it was Zope and maybe a couple of other things, but nothing really fit the way that we wanted to work. So we started building what became Django as, we called it the CMS, right? It was the content management system for this local newspaper. And the only reason it looks like a framework is that we weren't completely confident in how we were going to deploy it. There was an Apache module called modpython, which was similar to modperl. And we thought it looked great, but we were concerned that it didn't seem to be widely used. What happens if we use this thing and then it turns out to have been a mistake? So we built a very thin abstraction layer on top of it that gave us a request object and a response object. And then we figured we needed some kind of templating system. And so we ended up building the bits and pieces of a framework, mainly as an abstraction layer and as productivity tools to help us build these different newspaper websites. We had websites written in PHP that we were already responsible for that Adrian had built. And so we knew what the Python code needed to be able to do. So I've often thought about this in terms of Ruby on Rails was famously extracted from Basecamp. They built Basecamp and then they extracted a framework out of it. Django was a framework that grew to fit the requirements of a news website. We already had the website we needed to build. We wanted to replace it. So we grew out the capabilities we would need to do this news and entertainment website.
That's amazing. I mean, and I think the CMS theme runs throughout your career, but I'm curious, like, so you're at this website though, or this company, this news site, like how did you actually get them to publish it as open source?
So that's a really, really interesting story. And this actually happened after I left. So I was there for just under 12 months. I moved back to England. I think about 6 months later, they came up with the name Django because Adrian is a huge fan of Django Reinhardt, the gypsy jazz guitarist. And they made the case to the newspaper to open source it. I've talked to them about this. And apparently one of the things that helped was Ruby on Rails, because Ruby on Rails had just come out. It was getting all of this buzz. They went to the newspaper owners and said, look, we've done something like this. If we open source it, that all of these things can happen. There'll be more people working on it. There'll be people that we can hire. You know, this is clearly forging a really good path. But from the way they tell it, the most convincing argument they had is they went to the owners of this newspaper who were not technology people at all. And they said, look, we've been building technology for this company for years on Linux and on Python and all of these open source things. This is an opportunity for us to give back to that community that supported us. And that was the argument, that was the convincer, which got the newspaper on board with releasing all of this stuff as open source.
Oh, that's fantastic. I did not know that history. And I mean, and it's curious too, right? Because, you know, PHP was by far and away the big web language, and Python at that, you know, basically in the enterprise, you had Java, and for the really hardcore performance people, you had C and C++. If you're in scientific, maybe you're still doing Fortran. Python was emergent still at that time, right? I mean, it's not like it is today where Python is the dominant language.
No, that's entirely true. Like, certainly these days, Python is used for data science. None of that tooling existed back then. The website of Python, it was very nascent. It was people were still figuring out what's the best way to build things with Python. And yeah, so Adrian and I were Python enthusiasts who, mainly because we'd been running into the walls with PHP in terms of, you know, testability and being able to really understand how these large code bases worked. But honestly, it was a big gamble. You know, we were putting a lot of faith that this language would work out for us. And I think if a few months in it hadn't been working out, we'd probably have gone back to PHP. But we did manage to make pretty rapid progress. And by the end of my time at the newspaper, it had proved itself. We'd been churning around projects in a few days that previously would have taken us a few weeks.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it's still quite a popular framework these days, as I understand it. I don't do much web publishing myself these days. You know, looking at the site, it's still modern and fresh and it's kind of quote unquote kept up with the times, right?
It's interesting. Yeah, Django today, it's funny to say it's the safe choice now. In the Django community, we describe it's boring technology. If you want boring technology that's just going to work, it's got the features you need, it's not doing anything crazy and exciting, then Django's a really good fit. Although I've actually, I'm very excited about some of the upcoming Django features around this standard called ASTI ASGI, which is really about bringing asynchronous Python to Django space. So that means that you can build WebSockets and all of this, these asynchronous bits and pieces. And some of the work I've been doing most recently is built around that set of specifications.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, and I want to tie in then, because there's another through line, I think, through your career, which I teased out a little bit at the beginning. You know, you've got this content publishing side, and then you've got the computer science piece. And then, you know, I think at The Guardian, you know, we met talking offline, you really felt like this idea of data journalism came forward. And so spend a little bit of time talking about those early years of data journalism and kind of how they're interwoven with these other pieces of your career at this point.
I got to work for a newspaper for a year right at the start of my career, and we were building Django. One of the things we realized is that taking relational database technology, which was already something from the 70s, and applying it to the news, it was amazing how much exciting stuff you could get done. You know, this idea of a page on your website that shows you MP3s for bands who are playing in town this week, according to the calendar, that's a SQL join. You know, it's nothing exciting under the hood. Once you can get your data into a place where you can slice and dice it and query it in interesting ways, you can build really interesting stuff on top of it. Later on, 2009, I think, I went to work for The Guardian, where The Guardian, who were just coming off a multi-year giant content management system push where they'd been building a custom publishing system. And they were trying to get back into doing those sort of smaller interactive pieces that reflect the news going on at the time. And this is really the sort of core of data journalism, is the idea that you can use software engineering skills to help tell stories and to help break the news. But of course, the challenge there is that the news does not stand still. If you've got a story that comes along and there's a piece of software that you could write to help with that, but it takes 3 months, there was no point in building it because the news cycle has moved on to something else. So Django was always aimed to solve these kinds of problems. The original tagline for Django was web development on journalism deadlines. And at The Guardian, I got to start putting that into practice and saying, okay, this story is breaking. There is something we can build and get live that will help us dig into this story. My absolute favorite example from my time at The Guardian was a piece of work I did around an MP's expenses scandal, where members of parliament, the UK equivalent of Congress people, it turns out they'd all been making ridiculous claims on their expenses for years, and their expenses had not been released, so nobody could see what they were doing. But a freelancer working with The Guardian had campaigned for several years to get this data released. And she won the campaign. They were going to release the data. And then somebody leaked it to the Daily Telegraph, the sort of Guardian's biggest competitor, a couple of months in advance. So the Telegraph had 2 months with all of this expenses data to try and dig out the stories about people making claims for their duck houses and TV subscriptions and all of this stuff. So when the documents were finally released to us, we needed to find the stories in there really quickly. We ended up having a 1 week notice period that these documents were coming. And all we knew is that they were going to be like dodgy PDF files that we'd need to dive through. So I proposed a crowdsourcing system where we'd take all 20,000 pages of documents, stick them in a website, and have members of the public come along, see a random page of expenses, scan through it, and see if it looks like there was anything interesting in there or not. And we only had a week to get this thing live, but that's sort of the sweet spot for building these data journalism projects with Django. So we ended up putting out a website where any member of the public could come along, put in their postal code, the UK equivalent of a zip code. We'd show them their MP, and we'd say, here's the random page of their expenses. Does it look like there's anything interesting in here? And I think we churned through the entire collection in about 18 hours from launching this website, because people are very invested in seeing what their MPs have been doing and hunting down ways that they've been abusing the public purse. And it was a really fun project. We ran it a couple of times with improvements as more document dumps came out. It was actually quite influential in the wider world of news, because it sort of showed what you can do with these techniques. And there have been a bunch of other crowdsourcing projects from other organizations since then, which I only recently found out were inspired by what we've been working on at The Guardian.
And I want to say, I think that's where our lives intersected, because I recall I was visiting right around that time. I remember you guys talking about it.
It was a very exciting period of time at The Guardian, definitely.
So then I'm curious, right? So you've got, like I said, this through line around journalism and the news and engineering tied together, but then you have this other founding story, this project called Lanyard, this social network for conferences, if you will. Tell us a bit more about that founding experience and what it was like kind of going through the Y Combinator process and then all the way up to selling.
This is actually another story that comes out of a side project. My wife and I got married in 2010, and we decided that we were going to quit our jobs and go off traveling for as long as we could, like have the most extended honeymoon we could get away with. And we'd take laptops and we'd see if there were freelancing clients that we could work with and such like as we traveled. We set off traveling and we were trying to go mostly overland as well. We got as far as Casablanca in Morocco, and then we came down with food poisoning. Casablanca was not really on the main tourist trail through Morocco, and it was Ramadan, so all of the restaurants were shut. So we couldn't get anything to eat and we were pretty ill. So we figured, okay, well, we'll rent ourselves an apartment for a couple of weeks and we'll try and cook ourselves better and look after ourselves. And then since we weren't going anywhere, we figured, okay, well, how about we take one of those project ideas we've had and build that out and see if we can get that launched. The idea we'd had, and it was meant to be a side project to help our friends figure out which conferences to go to. We'd realized that we'd been missing great events that we'd have loved to go to, because even word of mouth wasn't strong enough. There was an event that was hosted at the Guardian offices. It was a geospatial hack day weekend thing. I didn't hear about it despite sitting next to the chap who was organizing it. We just didn't have the right conversation at the right time. So the idea with Lanyard originally was, people hang out on Twitter. People who speak at conferences generally have Twitter accounts. If we know the Twitter accounts of the speakers at the conference, then you can sign in with Twitter and we can go, oh, you follow Jeffrey Zeldman. Did you know he's speaking at this conference next month? And so it was conference recommendations through your Twitter social graph. And we very naively thought to ourselves, you know what? In the tech industry, there must be like hundreds of conferences a year. You know, the number is a lot bigger than that, it turns out. We built this thing. We had 2 weeks in Casablanca. We cobbled together the absolute minimal viable product, got it live. And then one thing we hadn't really counted on is that things that work off Twitter seem to be naturally viral, and conference speakers have more followers than the average Twitter user. So when we launched, we had 2 user accounts. That was myself and Natalie. And 100 profiles on the site, because we tracked down 100 people who we knew who were speaking at a conference. But that meant that if you signed into the site and you were following one of those 100 people, you'd get a relevant recommendation. And those 100 people were very incentivized to start tweeting about it. So the thing took off like an absolute rocket. I forget the exact numbers, but I think we had tens of thousands of users within a few days of launching. Which was tricky, because this was meant to be our little hobbyist side project while we traveled around Morocco on our honeymoon. And we kept on traveling. And by this, we got to Egypt about 6 weeks later. And it was becoming very apparent that this was not going to be just a little quiet side project that we'd work on every few weeks. We were getting email from people asking to talk to our support department. But this also intersected with Y Combinator putting out their call for applications for the next batch of Y Combinator companies. And in reading the stuff about Y Combinator, the idea at the time was it's easier to teach technologists how to be business people than it is to teach business people how to program. So YC would take people who were good with technology and knew nothing about business and fill in those missing gaps for you, which described the two of us down to a T. So we applied for Y Combinator from Egypt. We have a 1 minute video where we pitch our startup, where we've got the Luxor Temple is in the background. We decided not to even mention the location, just to have it as a nice piece of sort of background scenery. So we applied for Y Combinator. We got accepted for interviews, which you have to go to Mountain View for. We were in Egypt, so we needed to get to Mountain View for a literal 5 minute interview. They cover your travel costs, but not your international travel costs. But yeah, we flew out to Mountain View, and thankfully we made it through the interview. We got accepted into the program. And so come January of 2011, we cut short our honeymoon and moved out to Mountain View to spend 3 months doing Y Combinator.
Talk about a honeymoon, right? So you go from food poisoning delusional idea to viral Twitter idea to Y Combinator all in a matter of like, what, 3 weeks?
Yeah, it was something like that. It was a very compressed period of time. So, I mean, we did manage to spend 6 months traveling on honeymoon. So at least we didn't miss out on the honeymoon too much.
What a great founding story. And I want to pick out on that thread a little bit because you've mentioned side projects a little bit, not just a little bit, but a couple of times. And like, do you have a strategy for side projects, or is it just like, hey, I have an interest and I'm going to pull on that thread? Or has this been something you've kind of curated throughout your career?
I have so many side projects that I've worked on throughout time, and I've learned a bunch of lessons from them. One of the most important lessons I've learned is that if you're building a side project, it should not have user accounts, and it should not be responsible for anyone saving their data into it or anything like that. Because if you've got users, then your side project is not a side project. It's like an unpaid business. At the same time, the times that I've broken that, we ended up running a Y Combinator startup. So it's one of those pieces of advice which you need to know when to ignore. My side projects these days, I tend to be very careful about trying to make sure that they're not going to take over. My absolute favorite example of a recent side project is one that Natalie and I built together a couple of years ago called owlsnearme.com. And you can try this right now. If you go to www.owlsnearme.com, it's a website that will show you where your nearest owl is. It's great because it's static HTML. It's HTML and JavaScript. It's pulling data from the API of this amazing service called iNaturalist, where people report the animal sightings that they've had. So based on their API, we can say, okay, given your location, what are the nearest sightings that are within the owl tree of biology? I love that because it's really fun. It doesn't have user accounts. If it breaks, it's because iNaturalist broke. You know, it's not our fault. But it's a really good one for demonstrating to people. The other thing I've been doing recently is my side projects are all aggressively open source because, again, it's a way of avoiding causing harm if you lose interest in a side project. Now, if you've been putting a side project out and it's open source and somebody else is relying on it, then at least if you move on to other things, they have a chance of being able to keep that thing moving forward and keep it working for them.
I love it. And by the way, I think I see there's like 20 owls near me right now. So this is fantastic. In fact, it reminds me that there's this park near me that I need to go visit. So thank you for that, Simon. I'm curious to pull a little bit more here because one, it sounds like you and your wife both like doing this. So that is this like a shared thing together a lot? Do you each have your own? How do you find time to do this? And how do you set it? How do you build it into your week or into your schedule?
We collaborate very occasionally. I think I'm more focused on side projects these days. Natalie has been switching careers into conservation. And so she's been doing a lot of work with organizations like the California Bat Working Group. And she volunteers at the Marine Mammal Center in just north of San Francisco, which is the largest marine mammal hospital in the world. So she gets to look after elephant seals and sea lions and things. My strategy for side projects, partly I've been building a side project which itself enables new side projects. That's kind of the biggest productivity boost I've ever had is my principal side project, this project called Dataset, basically lets you build new side projects at an incredibly productive rate. So I will kick out side projects left, right, and center, and I can justify them because they're all helping me test out and figure out new features for the core project. A lot of it, I think, comes down to practice. It's knowing how to deploy things quickly, knowing how to use technology like CircleCI and GitHub Actions to automate things, having very strong guidelines that a side project needs to have the least amount of ongoing maintenance effort possible. If you automate absolutely everything about it, then you can sort of almost fire and forget on some of these projects, which I think is important if you're going to have a really wide array of projects as opposed to just a few core ones that you work on.
You've got like side project inception in there, Simon. If you can figure out how to automate the interview process for me for my side project, I will be forever in debt. So I'm curious, I want to come back and pick up on Lanyard and Eventbrite, and not so much the time at Eventbrite, but you know, many founders, you sell your baby, you do your lockup period, and then you get out. You actually stayed there for 6 years as director of architecture, which if I read your profile right, I'm pretty sure that's the longest you've actually stayed at one place. What you see a lot in engineering, which is I'm going to move on to the next idea, et cetera. What did you find there that you kept coming back to in terms of your own career and the place you were at in your life?
So one of the interesting things about the acquisition is when we were acquired, we were a six-person company. The way acquisitions tend to happen is you look at your options. You're like, okay, we either need to raise a Series A round, which means that you're locked into this project for realistically the next 5 to 10 years, or you investigate other options, which means you go and talk to companies and see if there's an acquisition out there. Part of it was we had to ask ourselves, is this the project we wanted to dedicate the next 5 to 10 years of our lives to? And it was also about looking at, okay, what's an interesting trajectory for our careers after this? So one of the ways I see Eventbrite is it was kind of a way of skipping several years of startup life, you know, the very difficult period where you grow from 6 people to 50. When we joined Eventbrite, it was definitely over 100 people, but it wasn't enormous. And then we got to like watch Eventbrite grow like by a factor of 10. So we got to ride that startup rocket ship from a slightly safer space. One of the great stresses of a startup is that the buck really does stop with you. If anything goes wrong, that's on you. And so we sort of saw employment as kind of a sort of rehab scheme for startups. It's almost like a retirement for startup founders to have a job where if payroll doesn't go out, that's somebody else's responsibility, you know? And so there was an aspect of, we'd been doing the startup thing for 3 years. It was really nice to not be in that position of total responsibility for everything that was happening. It was also just really fun watching what happens when a really well-managed company hits that growth spurt and grows eventually all the way to IPO. So I was there at Eventbrite when the company IPO'd last year.
Being on that rocket ship is quite a ride. Well, and so I think that brings us up to date, which is, you know, you just recently left. You've got this awesome sounding title of JSK Journalism Fellow. Tell us about that.
It's a program run out of Stanford University, and it's a fellowship program where every year they accept around about sort of 17 to 20 fellows out of the journalism industry. It's a very competitive application process. The fellows are then selected as people who get to spend a full year at Stanford working on projects relevant to journalism as a whole, but also sort of working on themselves. So you can take any class at Stanford. Actually, your spouse can as well. So Natalie's benefiting from Stanford classes too. You get to meet Stanford professors. You get the sort of the weight of the Stanford name behind you, which is a useful thing. And you get to spend a year thinking as well, which is kind of amazing when you've been like working furiously for years and years and years, to be able to take a year where you can actually think about yourself, think about projects you want to do, and think about your career in general. And so I've been taking classes, and I've been dedicating a lot of time to what was originally a side project, this data set project, and actually figuring out, okay, what's it going to take for this to really be useful for the news industry as a whole?
I love it. I've checked out the project, and I would encourage all of our listeners out there as well. There's some really cool things. I think in many ways, kind of what D3 did for data viz and data journalism, you know, 5-6 years ago, that came out of the news world as well. I can see where you're going with this as well, along those lines of not just the end visualization, but also all the munging, the shit work, if you will, behind data, right?
One of the ways I describe it is there's a huge amount of work going into big data these days. There are all of these amazing big like data warehouses and visualization tools and mechanisms for querying like thousands of terabytes of data. Not so many people are looking at the small data side of things. And small data is actually, in the world of journalism, like almost every data set you work with that supports a story is 100 megabytes, maybe a gigabyte or two. And these are things which don't just fit on your laptop, they'll fit on your phone. So there's something really interesting about saying, okay, what's the tooling that we can build that makes it as inexpensive and productive as possible to work with these data sets that might not fit in an Excel spreadsheet, but you definitely don't need a Hadoop cluster to work with them either.
If you could federate across things too, you might be able to do some really interesting joins and things like that across data sets. So that could be pretty powerful as well.
So a data set instance is a little SQLite database encapsulated in a interface and a JSON API. And you can run SQL directly against it. So because you can do custom SQL functions, I've been playing with the idea of SQL functions that hit other data set instances and pull back from them. So you could write SQL that queries your local data set, but sort of does a kind of join against a data set of US census data that's somewhere else and pulls it all together that way. There's a lot of really fun stuff you can do with that, I think.
Simon, you know, whenever I have both technical folks on, as well as those who have been in leadership roles, one of the questions I love to delve into is how they've managed their career in terms of staying technical versus going the management route, learning leadership skills, et cetera. How have you approached that in your career?
So this is something which I've thought a lot about, and I'm still not completely comfortable in sort of that I've figured out the right route for myself. One of the things I learned about management is management is a whole load of skills that have nothing to do with being good at engineering. I've spent time as a startup founder. I managed teams at Eventbrite. I actually, at one point, I was just really concerned that you pick the management track and you don't get to do the sort of creative, like the technological invention that you're doing before. And maybe you're really good at one thing and you're sort of so-so at the other. So should you stick with being an adequate manager when you're really good at this other thing? And then Charity Majors wrote this wonderful article about what she called the pendulum approach, where she said, if you swing into management and stay there, after sort of 3 or 4 years, your technical skills are no longer as relevant. And it's difficult for you to really help technical teams and help make great management decisions around technical problems. But what she suggested doing is essentially penduluming between the two, swinging from one to the other, but not staying stuck in one route at the expense of the other. If I can get that to work, I think that's the approach that I want to take. The other thing that's important to consider is the difference between leadership and management. In traditional technology companies, management, there's a lot of one-on-ones and filling in the quarterly reviews and all of that kind of stuff. But leadership is about a lot more than that. Leadership is about helping coach and grow a team. And so I think there's a lot of value in being somebody who's not a people manager, but who is taking on a role of mentorship and solving those organizational problems. I took on a mentorship position with HackBright Academy, which is a women's coding bootcamp in San Francisco, a couple of years ago, just to help develop those mentorship skills. And I found that really useful. And so I think my plan for the rest of my career is to try and find that oscillation, to spend some time as a sort of engineer with doing strategic engineering, research and development, and spend some time managing teams and see if I can figure out a way to balance sort of swinging between the two.
And of course, when you have side projects at the rate at which you have side projects, you know, you're never too far from the code, even if you are on the leadership or management side, I would imagine. I'm sure that's always kept you grounded, right?
The key thing with managing people is you can't take on tech projects where you're on the critical path to getting it shipped. That's what's going to break everything. But the great thing about side projects is that by definition, they don't have deadlines associated with them. You're not going to cause harm if you ignore your side project for a few weeks to work on something else. So yeah, I think they're a really important way to keep those technology skills rolling along, even when you're spending your sort of professional time in more of a management role.
Yeah, I love that. And I love also that you referenced Charity's thoughts on it. She was actually a guest on just a few episodes ago. For our listeners, be sure to check out her interviews as well. You know, and I know some in my own career, I still to this day, and I've been a CTO for a long time, I still struggle this. And I still imagine a future where I go back at some point and all I do is write code. And I like the people management side.
It's wonderful. You get to develop so many fascinating additional skills. I think one of the things that Charity said in the Pendulum piece is you need to be developing strengths on both sides of that thing. So one of the reasons to switch between those two roles is that you become a better engineer if you've got good management skills, and you become a better manager as your engineering skills improve.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it helps in so many ways to develop those communication skills. I think one of the things that really helped me too is the recognition that it's a different job, right? I think when you first go into tech management, you're like, oh, well, there's the word tech and there's the word management. Camille Fournier talks a lot about this in her book, Manager's Path, of like, you still have to be technical, but it's a fundamentally different role. And I love that you highlighted that for our listeners, because I think that's so important.
I'd second that book recommendation. The Manager's Path is such a good book on this stuff. The first chapter in that book is, so you want to be a manager, get mentorship figured out first. That was one of the reasons I started doubling down on my mentorship abilities, because it's such an important path on the way to being a genuinely really good manager.
Yeah, well, see, now, Simon, you keep bringing up all these good topics that I just want to keep talking. Spend a little bit of time on how you developed your mentorship skills, because that, again, is an area. It's not like there's a lot of books out there on how to be a mentor.
The most important thing about mentorship is showing up. It's actually finding opportunities, finding people who you can help, and making yourself available to them. A huge problem I feel that I have is that I'm very talkative. And what I don't want to do is be in a mentorship relationship where it's just me spraying information at people for an hour and then having them wander off. And so one of the approaches I take is I actually say to my mentees, one of the reasons I am doing this is I want to learn to get better at this. You know, this is absolutely for my own personal development. You know, if I'm interrupting you or if I'm going off down rabbit holes and I'm not being useful, please, please talk me back out of it and help me learn to be a better mentor. And I found that works really well, because mentees want to help you out. If you tell them that you're aggressively seeking feedback because you're trying to learn how to do this better, they will absolutely step up and help you do that.
That's fantastic. It reminds me, I had this coach, Steve Scanlon. He's got his own site. This is such a great soft skill. And I want to highlight it here, because I think you hit on this, something that's super helpful, which is you're showing this moment of vulnerability, and then you're using that as a means to learn and get better. One of the things Steve taught me was this phrase of, I don't know how to say what I'm about to say, but I think it's important that we need to talk about it. And that just unlocks so many things. And the coolest thing is, once I noticed, I'm curious, one of the things I really liked about what you said in there is this kind of showing vulnerability. And in many ways, that's a soft skill. And, you know, one of the things I think we've all had to learn as managers is soft skills. So reflect a little bit on where and how you've learned soft skills over the years.
It's interesting that the term soft skills has actually been banned by DjangoCon. So DjangoCon, the annual Django conference, they have a policy that they're not called soft skills anymore. They're called professional skills, because they're hard. Doing this stuff well, it's underplaying it to call them soft skills. But if you want, like, the difference between a junior developer and a senior developer, I think is it's soft skills and communication, right? It's being able to communicate effectively in a way that helps rise people up and isn't counterproductive is something which takes a long time to develop. So I think one of the things that's been most helpful for me is just acknowledging that actually this stuff is very, very difficult. And that makes it interesting. As engineers, we love taking on difficult problems. The moment you reframe mentorship and communication and coaching as things that are specifically difficult, complex skills to pick up, something in my engineering brain sort of perks up and says, okay, this is worth me spending time on. So acknowledging that they're difficult is an important starting point. And then, yeah, there's great material out there once you know to start looking for it. We talked about the Manager's Path already. There are blogs like Ask a Manager is a really fun blog for this kind of thing. But knowing that it's difficult and then actively practicing it and just being thoughtful about it, thinking, okay, did that go well? Like, was I helpful there? Have I just accidentally offended a team in a way that means they won't want to work with me again in the future? All of those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I love the reframing there. I said on LinkedIn the other day, soft skills, and somebody was like, no, Grant, they're interpersonal skills or they're emotional skills. And I do need to correct my own usage. Soft skills is such a ubiquitous term, but you're right. It's much more professional skills. It's the how do you show up at work skill. Simon, I want to thank you so much for all the time you've put in. We're definitely way over the hour that I promised you. I want to finish up with one final question, which is, where can our listeners best follow you? Where can they learn DataSet? Where can they find out more about this fellowship and Django and all the good things that you've done in your career?
I have a blog, which is at simonwillison.net, which I started in 2002, and I had a few years off, but it's essentially been running ever since then. So that I'm now updating it weekly because I try and write week notes about what I've been doing, mainly to keep myself honest and make sure that I'm spending my time on this fellowship as usefully as possible. And other than that, I'm on Twitter. I'm at Simon W on Twitter, and I tweet about technology stuff, but also rare New Zealand parrots and tiny obscure museums and all sorts of bits and pieces like that.
Oh, that's fantastic. So not only do we have owls, but we have rare New Zealand parrots. And you're saying kind of the kitschy small museums in the middle of nowhere, population 1,000 that just happened to be driving by and you're like, I need to stop there.
Because it turns out the best things about small museums is the smaller the museum is, the more likely the person who's in there is the person who founded it. And then you get to meet the person who created the Bigfoot Discovery Museum or the Pez Dispenser Museum or whatever.
Atlas Obscura, is that your go-to app for this?
I adore Atlas Obscura. I started building my own website for this, niche-museums.com. I launched about 6 months ago, which is just photos and write-ups of the ones that I've been to. This is a hobby which is currently on hiatus because of the pandemic, but I'm looking forward to going out there and exploring more of these museums in the future.
Yet another side project. And I'm a big fan of Roadside America. My son and I do this whenever we're out on a road trip as well, which is like, where's this kitschy, crazy thing? Let's go stop. So I love it. What a great way to end the show. For our listeners, we'll, of course, link up all of those resources in the show notes. Simon, so awesome to reconnect with you. Thank you so much for joining me again.
Thanks very much for having me. This has been really fun.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3, buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.